good to be in the safe, chaste hands of Dr. Steele, who withheld so much more than he could have told you. It's good to meet Grace in the first moments of one's presence. I remember my grand friend, Teacher Staley, following a speaker in this place by saying, "You never can tell by watching a frog on the bank how far he will jump." And this, I submit, is true. I know how far Steele could have jumped, and I'm grateful that he sat modestly on the bank and didn't jump at all. I am always astounded at how my classmates age, and I simply do not. I go on just the same, but Binkley and Luther and Dwight and your Old Testament people are just aging all around, and I just thank God you're still here. Given our Christian genius, which is not something about God, that's Jewish and very great, and we are beneficiaries of it. But given our genius, something about man, and given the essence of faith, which is a verb, and is therefore something about being that ends in persons. The question for me now is, how do we get at it again? Throughout his 57 years, in a huge, garishly lighted forge with furnaces and trip hammers and drop forges to heat and pound hot metal into shape, my father never made a knife or a gun or any weapon, just plows. Plows to cut and tear the rich soil of Georgia, Alabama, South Africa, Australia. They were turning plows, hillside plows, cultivators, gang plows, drag plows for orchards, plows for cotton and row crops, or for breaking up new ground with deep running, hard-chilled points to cut roots. Once I saw one of our plows leaning against a tree on a pineapple farm in Paraguay, and I wondered if I had hammered it out during some summer season. I remember best Daddy's way of designing new shapes for plows to do new tasks. With a block of tempered mortar, draw knife, calipers, and his eye, he carved a shape, cast the rough metal pattern, and then with hammer and anvil, finished his primal form from which millions like it could be made. I recall his anvil, still intact, with a half dozen split, burled hammers made useless and thrown aside, leaning against the base of the anvil. These are figures as old as Jeremiah and are symbols with which I can work again. Three times Jeremiah uses hammer. The word of God is a hammer that breaks the rock in pieces. The hammer of the earth is broken. And again, you, Cyrus, are my hammer. The hammer God would use to smash Babylon. It's a good, strong literary figure. God had used the Assyrian hammer and thrown it away. And the widows of Asher are loud in their wail, and the idols are broke in the temple of Baal. Or again, in 732 AD, Charles the Hammer had turned back the Muslim armor at Tours and Poitiers for the salvation of Western Europe from Muhammad. But in the Jeremiah fragment, the persistent metaphor is not hammer, it's sheep. Israel is a hunted sheep about to be restored to its pasture. Hammer is the weapon God will use against the enemy of the sheep. And as a consciousness of covenant takes hold, Yahweh is seen as kinsman redeemer who will do something. And Cyrus is his hammer for smashing stupid and empty forms. He will lead a breakthrough to freemanship. Centuries later, the church in its medieval splendor thought itself to be God's way of fulfilling God's craft in history. God would use the church as a hammer to make and shape kingdoms for the benefit of his sheep. The Reformation Church, and practically all Protestantism since, have felt our forms and our structures to be tools of the work of God on the world. Until lately. Beginning 10 years ago in a Christmas issue, Time cited a batch of then contemporary minor prophets as authority for news, late news, as if it had but recently happened that the church is in trouble and knows it's in trouble. News? Religious news? For 150 years, some Kierkegaard or Nietzsche or one of the neighbors has been telling us. We've been in trouble a long time, not just since you entered the ministry. In particular, it is true that this insight did not come with the space age. Indeed, this insight helped bring space age about. Atomic energy, modern orbiting devices, are byproducts of a new time noted more than 60 years ago in 1913, most graciously in a chapter entitled The Intellectual Temper of the Age, appearing in the volume Winds of Doctrine by George Santayana. Quote, the present age is a critical one and interesting to live in. The civilization characteristic of Christendom has not disappeared, yet another civilization has begun to take its place. 60 years ago. We still understand the value of religious faith. We still appreciate the pompous arts of our forefathers. We are brought up on academic architecture, sculpture, painting, poetry, and music. We still love monarchy and aristocracy and local institutions and class privileges and the authority of the family, and even cling tenaciously and dream of rejuvenating them. But on the other hand, 1913, the shell of Christendom is broken. The shell of Christendom is broken pre-World War I, Santayana said, broken by three hammers, the unconquerable mind of the East, the weight of our pagan past, and our industrial socialist future. These all confront Christendom with their authority. Hence, our whole life and mind are saturated with the slow upward movement of a new spirit, that of an emancipated atheistic international democracy. Now, the thought of an emancipated atheistic international democracy makes every North Carolina Tory shudder. But it probably carries, as it comes, something positive, something self-justified and deeply rooted in our nature. It has its moments, and it is pregnant with a morality all its own, and more, it has possession of us already. The new, as always, has crept up on us from the rear. And in the face of it, all around us, prelates and bishops and missionaries and new BD seminarians, eight of them last spring, are going back to honest work, are moving over into social action, and the extremes of reaction are both amiable and disquieting, both liberating and barbaric. Some of us are eager for it, for we are like Jonah, who would rather see Nineveh fall in than get saved. And others are, as Gerty said about his successive love affairs, it's so nice to see the moon rise while the sun is still mildly shining. But regardless of our attitude toward the new, since Santayana prophesied, all hell has broken loose to hasten the emergence of a secular age. New movements in theology have purported to face the new secularity with a new Christology, but this probably will not do either, for its proponents have no place for mystery and have committed the crime of the abomination of too much of our history. But be that as it may, we do have on our hands a world that does not really believe in God, a secular world with an ethic of shifting utilitarian authorities. And this confusion is contained in none of our systems. Everything is threatened, and the disturbance is at home in the average parish. But what a great stir and buzzing in the world. Such a writhing, striving quest on the part of the literate churches to find out how to work in this new world. Just what is coming off here? I do not know, and I dare not try to say, unless, hopefully, it's something such as Abraham Maslow calls our enmanning, or something Dietrich Bonhoeffer would have hoped for in the phrase, man come of age, or most hopefully what Pierre Teilhard de Chardin was talking about in the divinization of the human. Whatever it may be, it's no time to bail out. Come, join in the revolution. For while you can be sure that the Christian faith will change, you may also be certain that we still have somewhat to say. After all, man, the subject we know most about and have most to say about, man is at the center of the storm. And we have this capacity for talking to and about man for a purpose, to be a hammer of God in the world. And here we ought neither to be trapped nor diverted. We ought not to blunt our hammer on work others can do better. We really do not need to build a Christian sewer system. While even our efforts to make a Christian educational system are often woefully unchristian and generally poor education. We ought not to get in the way of better hammers God has got. There's no such thing as a Lutheran algebra. Nor are we to beat on one little corner of the work till it's misshapen and twisted. We have our own work. And our work is to make persons in this world. Persons who will make a society fit to live in a kingdom that comes, has come, and is coming. And the very tools of our trade equip us best of all to hear and to call out persons for the work God is doing in the star. Now, God has many hammers at work in the world, but I think the church is not one of them. Anytime we've tried to play the hammer, we have broken our own head. And here we are. The shell of Christendom is broken. It is not our age to rule. Instead, we see an emergent, emancipated, atheistic, international democracy. The big hammer, however, is still the restless, eager spirit of man. And the church, we're not a hammer. We're a people whose leader is a lamb. That gorgeous thing of William Blake's 1769, little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? We're not a hammer. We're a lamb. Now, we're a healthy lamb statistically, but we're a fifth-rate force in the world. And don't you forget it. You quit expecting to lead. You're fifth rate or you wouldn't be here. As Arnold Cohn put it in Agents of Reconciliation, the church finds itself today in the anomalous position of being resurrected in body but still looking for its spirit. If the German state church could list 95% of its citizens as members, with 5% actively involved, we could do almost that well. The American church is subject to another kind of enslavement. What difference does it make, really, whether we're talking of legal establishment or cultural identification? They're the same thing. The anvil upon which the shape of the American church has been hammered out is our culture, not vice versa. We tried to shape America and we got shaped. The force we were able to apply, while considerable, was never as great as we had thought and was more mystic in character than real. Our stupid notions about the Christian devotion of the colonists were terribly exaggerated. The colonists really were after something else. Less than 5% of colonials in the earliest 18th century had any church connection at all. It's true that certain spiritual ideas had a place, but so did spiritual ideas have a place in Rome, in Greece, in the Renaissance, in the French Revolution. The really effective operational base of American culture was not Christianity, it was a kind of nature worship. Not till the atomic age did anything break on Europe to compete with the discovery of the New World in the late 15th century. From the early 1500s into the 1800s, the literature is filled with impossible extravagances of nature in the New World, especially among Spaniards and Anglo-Saxons. The profound influence, the dominant place of, the radical devotion to nature is the development of America from 1640 to 1970. They talked about Niagara and the Valley of the Genesee, the Ohio Valley, the High Plains, the Great Mountains, the Great Lakes, the Southern Pampas, the Mississippi Valley, the Great Desert, the West Coast. These were the places for timber, hides, beef, oil, iron, coal, wheat, corn, cotton, silver, and gold. The acquisition of any of these pitted a man against nature, and nature was unbounded in her willingness to bless the strong man. This is a great source of our vaunted individualism, which all the frontier denominations made into a dogma. This is the frontier spirit. In the main, by the 1880s, the new cities, where cotton, wool, and silk became fashion, where ore became steel, where cattle turned into beef and sausage, these were the province of later immigrants, except for a trading, banking constabulary of old families. But all were European, and all believed in the special qualities of nature in the New World. Hence, the concepts of nature's bigness, her prodigality, were the real shaping of American enterprise. Every American insurance empire rests on the worship of nature. It's the way things are here, plant and grow. This is nature's way. Our attitudes toward other peoples and nations in less fortunate locations is an extension of this adulation of nature's local expansiveness. Big business is really not so much reflective of a European or Italian banker's model. It's rather a reproduction of nature's scheme of things. You plant and you hoe and you water and you work and you wait and you will reap. And nature's still big business. Our past then is not so much a mere materialism as it is a naturalism. That is to say, our creed means the way of nature, and therefore the way of God, is always the way of expansion. From the 1890s and the time of the earlier Roosevelt, this meant foreign expansion. Free land was gone. The widely scattered parts were tied together by ribbons of steel, and the new grain land, timber land, irrigated cotton land, and produce land was absorbed along the lines of the rail network. The desperate effort of Republicans to extend their half a century dominance past Hoover, President Hoover, without free land for nature's expansion would have been the same with any other party in power. The demand was for expansion. To this day, the company that cannot expand can only merge with one that can expand or shrivel. The big ideas were nature and expansion. That is to say, nature's way is the way of expansion. When land runs out, you trade and ship abroad like now. You hunt new markets. The Philippine War was fought, in part at least, to lay a base for China trade. The effects on American Christianity, the shaping power of this cultural anvil, incalculable. Notice, where were the big centers of American Protestant mission? China, Brazil, West Africa. Now go read the speeches of McKinley and Cleveland and Roosevelt and William Jennings Bryan. Where did we wish to trade? Number one was China, which we had to have to make our West Coast, and where we ached to replace Great Britain. Then we needed Brazil, where we welcomed the republicanization symbolized in the fairly quiet fall from power of the Portuguese Emperor Dom Pedro, the best they ever had so far. Then West Africa, the Congo Basin, opening up for ivory and dye, which we wanted, and timber, which we did not want, not even yet. There had been British missionaries on every boat to India for 100 years. But the flag was that of the East India Trading Company. Look, Miss Lottie Moon, the Hudsons, the Inland China Mission, and 100 others. They all went to China under the greatest flag of concern to trade with China in our economic history. You tell me what this means. Miss Moon did not know this, nor did I till here of late. And Miss Lottie broke her engagement to Crawford Toy, of later Harvard fame, but then being fired at Louisville for what they thought was Unitarianism. And Miss Lottie said she must give her life to God's service in China. And hundreds both preceded and followed. But who can minimize the wave of economic expansion that sent them all a-serving? Except that I have in my files a photostatic copy of the 6 pages of the Harvard faculty minutes voted in appreciation on the day Crawford Toy retired after a life of being estranged from Lottie Moon. This cultural anvil shaped other matters except missions among the denominations. Nature's notion of expansion became God's way in everything that mattered to the denominations. Expansion, expansion, evangelism, organization, statistical prowess, stewardship, competition, missions. In spite of the power that moves me to this day to tears of that early Moravian, ye Christian heralds go proclaim, and the gorgeous later, in Christ there is no east or west. Look at the hymns of the 1890s to the 1920s. Read the official house organ theologies. Read the journals of work from D.L. Moody's place at Northampton to Chautauqua. The minutes of officials. The denominational histories, the paths of synodical leadership, the new communion with banks and bankers, the financial campaigns of the 20s, the wave of physical expansion, and the proliferation of concern for denominationally oriented sectarian education which saw the birth of more than 600 small colleges in less than 50 years. And then let's not talk so much about communist notions of economic determinism. That's only half of that idea. The president of the biggest bank in Charlotte said to me 15 years ago, "I kicked in my share on the Billy Graham meeting. It'll bring as much to town as when the Washington Senators opened here last year." Who is using whom? And what is our driving force? Against this shaping anvil, that nature's way is the way of expansion. After decades of blindness, the church here and there has life enough to grope for its proper shape and spirit. And this contemporary insight is forcing us into a reconstruction of our legitimate world mission, legitimate evangelism and education. And we are discovering, by way of the recovery of the motifs of Old Testament life, we are discovering a pristinely clear model. For example, Isaiah 41 and following is a protest against the cultural anvil that was shaping their gospel too. The shaping force then as now, the cultural values of a people, were a culture that rested on their own craft with nature. And the burden of the prophet is and was that the meaning and purpose of their community had a different end. Yahweh speaks, "But you, Israel, are my servant. You are different because you are mine. You will wear out the anvils of the culture that would shape you." Now, what about our quest for the church's proper spirit? In this new world, this new international, atheistic, emancipated democracy that has cracked the shell of Christendom, against this expansion of the notion of nature's way as expansion, how shall we live in the gospel? We are being, it seems to me, forced to see the preliminary nature of all our life and work behind us. We are being forced to discover, dear friends, that your gospel is not a hangover of the past. Our gospel began beyond where we are now, not behind us. The Christian faith is incredibly sophisticated, in that the gospel began beyond our present stage of involvement with nature and craft. We are forced to come to terms with cultures, Canaan, who passed their nature phase because they had exploited all their resources 3,000 years ago. What the gospel is talking about began beyond the worship of nature and craft in a world that had already exhausted its reliance on nature's prodigality. We are being pressed into the discovery of relations that simply have no economic bottom, base, or condition, or I wouldn't have the nerve to preach in a pair of $4.98 jeans instead of tailored pants like you're supposed to wear when you've been to school a long time. The crust we have to share is token of an enriched poverty that has no alternative to accepting its nearly 900 million new neighbors. We have to get social, if not socialistic, because we have to have our neighbors. We have to care for Asia, Africa, and Latin America because we are in the same world, not because we are rich. Which is to say, we are forced to give up our reliance on nature's way. It betrays us. Christian ethic begins beyond a nature worship which empties us, and now we must catch up with our origin. After a 2,000-year run delay, this means that our only business is the calling into being of persons, all kinds, sorts, and kingdoms of persons, and this changes everything. It changes preaching, worship, ethics, direction, education, evangelism, mission, even stewardship. And this now means a shift of base. for the future is the Christian orientation of adults. If a present generation of adults cannot see this, we have no chance. We haven't the time to show it to children as our hope. The kids have already abandoned what they never had. This means a new scheme of adult Christian orientation that can stand to face the myth systems that have contributed to such a misshaping of the Lamb of God, to which now I turn for the last, the shaping of the Lamb. Who has been tampering with the soul of the church? Briefly, we all have. Simon Magus in the Acts of the Apostles tried to buy it. It would be to our advantage too if we could shape the soul of the church, if we could find it. God help.